We're going to be continuing on in our series on identity theft this morning. And so if you haven't been here the last couple of weeks, basically what we're talking about is we're going through a series about how we as Christians have lost track of the identity that God has made us for. And, you know, over time and through culture and all that stuff, the place where we were supposed to be, the identity that God made us for, has been kind of shifted because of culture and its influence on our lives, and us slowly over time buying into that. And so we at this church right now are going through trying to figure out, how do we reclaim the identity that God has for us? And we're doing that by going through Galatians 5, 22 through 23, the fruit of the Spirit, and spending 1 week on each of those and trying to figure out, how do we exhibit those in our lives the way that God made for us to do? And so I'm excited for this morning because I got a good one. And if you don't know the order, it goes love, and then the next one is joy. And who doesn't want to spend a morning talking about joy? I mean, that's just like, you know, the best thing you could talk about. Or, I mean, there's lots of things, but that's a pretty good one. And so I'm looking forward to that. And you know what's cool about joy is that it's something that God always promises us that we can experience throughout our entire lives, with his help, of course. It's not like happiness, which is something, or, you know, excitement that can go up or down depending on the seasons and the life that we're in the situations that we're dealt. Joy is something that God offers us a chance to experience for all eternity because of our relationship with him. But as you know, it's not a given that we will just naturally be experiencing that joy in our lives. There's parts that go into that, and we're going to break that down this morning and try to figure out, how do we reclaim joy in our life the way God called us to. And you see, one of the things that we need to first look at is just how different our culture is and what it says about joy, because I think in a lot of ways it's pretty backwards. And so I just want to start by just looking at what our culture says will bring joy. First, it says that we find joy through our personal accomplishments, by meeting our own goals, our own desires, our own things that we're aiming for, whether it's success in our careers or some other thing that we're looking forward to. Our accomplishments are what brings us joy, as they say. Or what about making money? The more we have, the easier life will be, and the more joy we'll get to experience. Isn't that what the world says? Or what about being popular? The more people who like us, the more joy we'll have. There's like this idea that we think that that's how it works. Or having stuff. I love that, having stuff. I was like, what kind of a lame point is that? Stuff, it's in there. But having things, anything that's important to us, the culture says, can bring us joy. You know, whether it's technology or musical instruments or guns or cars or whatever the things are, Beanie Babies. Or if you're one of the really trendy new people, even catching Pokemon in Pokemon Go, right? You gotta get them all, you gotta have more stuff, right? I know we have some players in this church, so just thought I'd throw that out there. Whatever floats your boat, right? Stuff. What about the next one? Rest and relaxation. You know, those people that are just like going through their days, and the thing that they're living for and the things that they're aiming for is just that the next rest, the next time that they can relax, their next vacation, the next Labor Day weekend. Maybe I got some of you right there. And they're just looking for that. And that's just like, you know, if I can just finally get that experience, if I can finally find rest, then I'll have joy. And that's what they're aiming for. Or what about entertainment, right? Watching the big game. I know it's football season. I know what Saturdays are. I know what Monday nights are. I know what's going on right now. And a lot of us are just like, okay, I just can't wait. It's got to get to the weekend. Got to watch the game. Can't wait to America's Got Talent or The Voice or whatever your favorite show is, Dancing with the Stars. Who knows? But we're just like, that's where I'm going to find joy this week. What about sexuality? We're going to be talking about this in our men's study this fall, but even just, you know, pornography and sexuality and sexual addiction and, you know, hookups and sex outside of marriage and all that stuff. And our culture says, and if you watch any sitcom, it's like what's being advertised, is that that's where you find joy. But that's not true. And lastly, even our relationships, whether it's with our friends or with our relationships with, you know, maybe the person we're going to spend the rest of our life with, the culture says that that's where joy is. Maybe even that that's the ultimate joy. It's with you, with other people. But even that, some of these things are good things, are not the full things of joy, the full picture of joy that God has for us. And when you look at this situation in general, our culture's attitude is that we find joy when we get the things that we want. It's about us. But this isn't right. And just so you guys know, I'm not saying that these things are evil things. Just to be really clear, these things, you know, if you happen to be a rich guy who lots of people like, you know, that doesn't mean that you're in sin. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that when that's the source of our joy and that's what we're aiming for, to find the joy in our lives, that we're missing out on part of what God has for us. And so let's kind of unpack this morning. And I think that one of the reasons why we don't experience God's joy in our lives is because we don't fully understand what it is to begin with. Like we don't have our head around it all the way. And so I want to make it really clear for us before we do anything else this morning about what is joy and where does it come from. And so we're going to look at a passage in the Bible that I think really highlights this well. And if any of you guys have been in the church for a while, you're probably thinking, all right, I know what character we're going to be talking about this morning. It's the one we always talk about when we talk about joy. It is, any guesses? No? Maybe not. Maybe I thought it was obvious. The Apostle Paul, right? I've heard so many sermons on Philippians and Paul finding joy in prison and Paul finding all this joy throughout life. I bet some of you guys have as well. But we're not going to talk about Paul this morning because even though he's a great person for us to talk about, there's other characters that I think are really helpful as well. And we're going to look at one of them that I think deserves more attention than he gets. And that character is John the Baptist. So open up with me, if you would, to John chapter 3, verses 22 through 30. John chapter 3, verses 22 through 30. And you might have already noticed this morning, but I kind of left the outlines blank for you guys so that if you're one of those people who doesn't like, you know, like the full book that Rob will offer you with like 5 pages front and back with like detailed bullet points, you can just kind of create your own canvas this morning. So I love you, Rob, I know you're in here somewhere, but so it's kind of a, you know, do it as you'd like this morning in that regard. But who is John the Baptist? John the Baptist was Jesus' cousin. His father, Zechariah, was a priest, so he kind of grew up in that environment. He was the founder of the Baptist denomination. Did you guys know that? I got one laugh. I think that was Jeff Duro. He wasn't the founder of the Baptist denomination. Even though his name was John the Baptist, that wasn't part of who he was. The Baptist denomination actually started 1,600 years later. And so some people call him John the Baptizer just to really distinguish, like, not the, you know, he baptized people, John the Baptist. And so just to clarify that. He was kind of an odd guy. He was a guy who wore camel's fur for clothing. He ate locusts and honey. Kind of had some weird taste there. There probably was some spiritual part of that that was going on, but that was how he rolled. His primary mission from God was to prepare the way for Jesus' ministry. He was the forerunner, right? That was his role. That was his job. We're going to talk about that. It ties into our message this morning. Many people love John. He was like a hero to a lot of people. There would be people that would come for miles and miles and travel for long periods of time to go and to sit under John's teaching and hear what he had to say and be baptized by John. And there was like this movement around him. And they just loved him and they praised him and they cheered his name. And he had a lot of disciples and a lot of followers, but he wasn't arrogant. We're going to talk about that too. But out of all the things that we know about John the Baptist, nothing about him sticks out to me more than a comment that Jesus made about John in both Matthew 11:11 and Luke chapter 7, verse 28. But we're going to look at Matthew 11:11. I love this. This is crazy. Jesus says about John, he says this, "Truly I say to you, among those born of women, there has arisen no one greater than John the Baptist." Now, if you're like me and somebody said that to you, just any random person, you'd be like, wow, I feel like that was such a huge compliment. Somebody thinks that no one that has been born of women is greater than me. Wow, that's so crazy. But it's not just anybody saying this. This is Jesus saying this about John the Baptist. This is one of the highest compliments you can think of to give a man. And Jesus bestowed it upon John. Clearly, he was a great guy. Clearly, he was an amazing man. And we're going to see part of that come out in the passage we're going to be looking at this morning. So that's a little bit about him. And it's helpful for us to know that so we can just really have a good framework of what's happening in this interaction we're going to be looking at in John chapter 3. So let's look at that together. We're going to start with 22 through 24. We're going to take it one chunk at a time. So let's do that. Verse 22. And the Apostle John's going to kind of set the scene for us as he's writing this book. After this, Jesus and his disciples went into the Judean countryside. He had just been ministering in Jerusalem, right? So now he's leaving there. And he remained there with them and was baptizing. John also was baptizing at Aenon near Salem because water was plentiful there. And people were coming and being baptized, for John had not yet been put in prison. And so Jesus leaves Jerusalem. He had just been talking with Nicodemus, you know, John 3:16, all that good stuff that we just came before this. And he goes out and he goes to this place where John the Baptist had been was one of his places where he was baptizing. And we know that it was maybe a spring-like environment, they say, as I was reading. And there's water there. And so lots of people came to get baptized there because it was one of the places that they could. And Jesus shows up there, and he starts baptizing. All sorts of people are coming, and down the way a little bit, I don't know exactly what it looked like, but John was there, and they were both aware that they were there with each other, both baptizing at the same time. I don't know exactly what the picture looked like, but they were both very aware that they were there, baptizing together, different people. In the midst of that, a situation is going to come up between the disciples and John. So let's read that together in verses 25 and 26. Now a discussion arose between some of John's disciples and a Jew over purification. And they came to John and said to him, Rabbi, he who is with you across the Jordan, Jesus, to whom you bore witness, look, he is baptizing and all are going to him. And so John's disciples and the Jew are having this discussion about purification and baptism and these things. And then part of that, they get to this point where there's this conflict, right? And the disciples are not happy with what's going on. And so they come to John and they voice a couple concerns to him. The first thing that they express is that they realize that, well, these two guys that are here, John the Baptist and Jesus are there, that everybody is not going to John the Baptist. Most of them are going to Jesus, in fact, and John the Baptist is kind of like standing around like, all right, cool, they're doing their thing over there. And they're upset about that because they love John and they want to see John succeed, and they're almost even feeling like Jesus is stepping on John's toes. And they're wondering maybe something like, did Jesus miss the memo? I mean, did they not get a copy of John's business card? It says John the Baptist, right? Like this is part of, it's in his name. Like this is the thing he does. He baptizes people. Like what's Jesus thinking here? And then secondly, they feel betrayed by Jesus, maybe even a little bit, some scholars suggest, because maybe they felt like, well, because John had just baptized Jesus not too long ago, that isn't it kind of rude for Jesus to be repaying that baptism by baptizing other people and stealing John's thunder? Isn't that kind of inconsiderate of Jesus? And ultimately, they don't think that what Jesus is doing is right, and they feel that John deserves more than what he's getting in the situation. And so John comes back, and what we're going to read now is John's response to these concerns the disciples are expressing to them. And I love John's response. I'm so excited to walk through it with you this morning. And so we're going to just take a gander at verses 27 and 28. John answered, "A person cannot receive even one thing unless it is given him from heaven. You yourselves bear witness that I said, I am not the Christ, but I have been sent before him." He starts off by reminding his disciples of an important truth that is from the Bible, that nothing of value, nothing of meaning can be given to you unless it is given to you from God in heaven. And so all the talents, all of our resources, all of our accomplishments, all of our successes, all those things, whatever they are, they don't matter unless God gives them to us. Why does John say this as part of his response? Because John knows what's in his disciples' hearts. He knows what they're thinking. They're thinking something like, John, you don't have to be the second-rate guy compared to this Jesus fellow. Think of all the power that you could have. Think of all the people who came from miles to come and to sit underneath your teaching and to be baptized under you that came and cheered your name and that loved you and treasured you. Think of all those people, John. You don't have to be the second-rate guy to this other Jesus fellow. You don't have to walk in this guy's shadow. You don't have to let him take the show. But John doesn't let it fly. And by saying his response, he's communicating, no, that's not what God made me for. I know who God made me to be, and my life is not about myself. My life is about making Jesus great, and he is the star of the show, and that's where I am going to be happy being. And he goes on in verse 28 to say expressly that, "Remember what I told you before, that I am not the Christ, Jesus is, and I have been sent before him. I have been sent to prepare the way for him. I was not sent to take his place or to take glory from me." I think that's what he's articulating in those verses. And I want us to take a step back this morning and just think about this situation here. Because here you have a guy named John. I want you to put yourself in John's shoes. A guy who has all these gifts, all these abilities. He has all this love from these people, all these people that to celebrate him. And you have this opportunity almost to bite into this temptation that you might feel to go and to become that man that would have been so great and to have earned so much glory for himself and to find all these all the things that the world says will bring joy. He could have taken those on for himself, and he has that opportunity. And I ask myself, would I be tempted with that? Would I feel that in my heart? And I think if I'm being honest, there's part of me that would feel tempted by that because John had all these gifts. He was such a great guy. Couldn't he have done that? But John doesn't want them. I love that. Because he knows his place and he knows God's plan for him. And we get to verses 29 and 30, which are just so cool. 29 says this, and he gives us an illustration to think about. The one who has the bride is the bridegroom. The friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly at the bridegroom's voice. He breaks this into an illustration to make a point. And the point is kind of similar. There's a lot of weddings going on right now, so I think for a lot of us it's kind of familiar to think about. But this idea that almost like a groomsman in a wedding that John is taking in and filling this role for the Lord. The groomsman's job is to do what? Is to support the groom, is to make the groom's day great. And Jesus, as we see in Scripture, is the bridegroom and the church is the bride. And that is the ultimate story that we're looking at. And John's just saying, you know what? It's my role to be his friend and to be his advocate and to be there. And when the bridegroom, it says, when he raises his voice, I'm going to rejoice and I'm going to glorify him too. And I'm going to celebrate those things because my life isn't about me. My life's about him. So cool. And I love 29 through 30. And it's just the thing that I want us to hone in on this morning is how he kind of comes out of this section. He says this. Therefore, this joy of mine is now complete. He must increase, but I must decrease. He says his joy is complete. It's at its full. It's as good as it could be on earth. He is there. He is experiencing the fullness of joy, being the number two guy to Jesus. That is the truth for us, and that's where joy comes from. And at the end, and he says clearly this biblical formula even of where joy is. And it's not one we'd expect if we were looking at it from culture's eyes, but it says in verse 30, this, it says, he must increase, but I must decrease. If you're wondering, how do you find joy in your life? That is the answer. The more we understand our relationship with God, and the more we make him the center of our lives and the thing that we are pointing towards and we are in just directing our lives towards and the things we're trying to make the most important, when he is that, then we will experience joy in our lives. And when in the process, we ourselves will be put below him. He must increase, but I must decrease. And our actions need to show this. We need to show it in our quiet times, in the way we pursue our relationship with him. They'll show it in the way we serve others, in the way we serve as lights in the world around us, in the way that we share our faith with other people and express and share the love of the gospel that has changed our lives. We'll share that light, we'll share that joy when we walk through hard times with other people and we be a servant to them in those seasons as well. These are the places, these are the types of places where we find joy in this world. And when we live this way, that's what we experience. Getting that promotion at work, it doesn't come close. Watching Netflix on the weekend doesn't even come close. Drugs and alcohol, they don't even come close. Sexuality doesn't even come close. Buying your dream home doesn't even come close because nothing comes close to the joy that we can experience through our relationship with Christ Jesus. And when we get it wrong, we end up feeling tired and worn out and unsatisfied. I hope this has painted a pretty clear picture of what joy is and where it comes from. But there's another component of joy that I want to talk about this morning. Because there's a lot of us in this room that have gone through some really hard things. There's a lot of us that have been through difficult seasons, whether it's the loss of a loved one, a job loss, an illness that has just been so taxing on you and the family. Whatever those things are. And we know that in those moments, sometimes it can be really hard to come to a place where we can find this joy that God has called us to and wants us to experience each day. But the gospel is big enough that we might find joy in those places. And so I want to talk about how do we find joy in even the darkest times? And as I said earlier, I want to say it again, the gospel and the Bible, they don't say that we're going to always experience happiness in our lives. That's not true. Some people try to say that. There's pastors that are very successful that say that, but that's not true, because even Jesus, when you look at his story, experienced suffering, right? He was persecuted. He was hated by some. He was tortured and he was put on the cross. I think, and there were some of these moments where he was not say he was happy in those moments, but I think through them all, the Bible says that he could find joy because he knew that he was serving the Father. And we're going to kind of break that apart. And so the same is true for us. God doesn't expect us to be happy at all seasons of our life, whether we're mourning, we're dealing with battles, experiencing heartaches. But he does say that we can find joy in those things. Flip forward a few books with me, if you would, to James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. And we're going to read a passage that I think is really helpful for us just to understand the breadth that God's joy can be for us. We'll read it and then we'll kind of break it, just talk about it briefly here. James says this, "Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, and let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." James is not a guy who is unfamiliar with trial. He was a guy who lived, especially in his later years, sold out for the Lord. He watched as people he cared about were persecuted, and he himself was persecuted. He watched as people he cared about died from both natural and unnatural causes because of their faith and because of other things as well. They're just, this is the course of life. But he walked through those dark seasons. He watched as his brother, Jesus, was tortured and crucified, and he experienced that loss and the shame that brought and all those things that he went through. And there's so many things more that James experienced in this life. But it's safe to say the trial is something that he was familiar with. And what does he say about it? What does he say about going through trials? He says, "Consider it all joy when you experience trials." James, what are you talking about? Like, haven't you been through these situations? Like, don't you know how hard it can be? But he says, no, that's not what's going on here. We should be able to find joy in those moments. And what James is saying is that we can find joy in the knowledge that every trial that we face is an opportunity for us to grow in our relationship with God and in our dependence on him, to rise to the occasion. And it's also a chance for us to bring God honor and praise through our actions. In other words, as John the Baptist just said, it's a chance for us to make God increase and to make us decrease. And as believers, we can find great joy in all of these things. The greater the trial, the greater the opportunity to grow in our relationship with God, and the greater the opportunity to bring him glory. I want to unpack this more, but rather than me just coming up here and talking and sharing more about this, what I want to do now is just take a moment to hear a story from a young woman from our congregation named Allie Brown. Allie's a woman who has got an amazing story, and she would be here with us this morning sharing it live, but she just left for the mission field, praise the Lord, and so she's not here this morning, but we're going to look and we're going to see how she experienced joy through trial in her life and in her family's journey through their battle with Huntington's disease. And so if you're not sure what that is, Allie's going to explain it in the video, so let's just turn our eyes to the screen for the next 8 minutes or so as we watch this powerful video.
For taking time to share your testimony with us. And why don't you begin by telling us a little bit about what Huntington's disease is, and then also share with us about the probability of it being passed down from a parent to a child.
Well, Huntington's disease is a disease where over time your brain cells slowly die. So within that time span that you find out that you have it, it's called your onset. So you experience a whole bunch of symptoms like bipolar, aggressive, you can be super suicidal, there's schizophrenia that can be a part of it, and there's a lot of other awful, there's a lot of them. And so all the ones that I described are all the ones that my mom had and I experienced firsthand from my mom. And so the probability of a mother to a child is that it's a 50-50 chance. So whoever has Huntington's, when they have a child, that child has a 50-50 chance of inheriting Huntington's disease.
Okay. Now, with the probability of it being passed down from a parent to a child so high, and with your mom having had Huntington's disease, you and your family would want to go and check out and get tested. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about the process that you and your sister went through with getting tested? And then not only that, but what was the outcome, and what was that process like for you?
Part of the process of getting tested is that you have to go through therapy, and you have to talk to people about it. It's this big process before you find out, you know, what this thing is going to do, because it pretty much determines the rest of your life. So I was, just this past December, I decided I want to get tested, because I was in a sophomore in college, and I was also in a serious relationship. And so I kind of started thinking that, you know, if things are going to be long term, I kind of want to know what my life is going to hold. Is it going to hold this huge weight on my shoulder like Huntington's disease, or I'm going to be free of it? I remember walking into the doctor's office, and just my heart felt like it just wanted to run out of my chest. Like, I was thinking that I know that from this day forward that my life is going to change, that it's going to be different, you know? And so the doctor came in, and I knew from the second that he came in, because his head was just hanging low, and he had this look on his face and demeanor about himself that just seemed very, like, upset and didn't want to say what he was about to say. So I knew what he was gonna say. And then he ended up telling me that I do have Huntington's disease, and I remember in that moment just feeling so, one of the biggest ones is feeling so scared, because I didn't know what was going on, and it didn't make sense. And especially after everything that I'd been through growing up, I for sure thought that this was going to be my happily ever after, and he was going to come in and say, you don't have it and you're free to go. And, you know, I didn't expect me to come in and he say that I did have it. And then on top of that, he told me that I have 52 repeats of the gene, and that means that I have a pretty bad case of it, in the sense of that 52 means that my symptoms will probably start in my late 20s, early 30s, and I'm 20 now. So that was another like huge giant rock on my chest when he said that. So it was really hard in that moment to be able to process, like, what is the next step from this?
I can't imagine what it must have been like for you, obviously receiving that diagnosis, the fear that would come with that. And yet the first time that you and I met and talked about this, I remember so distinctly being touched by your response and talking about how you went from this place to fear and then allowing God to pick you up and take you along. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
In that moment, as crazy as it sounds, I felt this overwhelming of just peace, and that I'm with you and that things are going to be okay. And I didn't really understand what that meant in that moment, but I knew that that was the beginning of trusting the Lord, because I was like, okay, he was going to be able to do that, and that was going to be able to get me out the door. And instead of, you know, coming out and falling to my face and just crying and be like, I'm not moving and I want to stay here. That was the first thing. And then that night, because like any normal person, no one would sleep after finding out something that huge about their life. So I was up Googling, doing all the things you probably shouldn't do, but I was doing and freaking myself out even more about all of it. And so I realized that I had to make a couple decisions, in the sense of the first thing, I had to, you know, decide if I was going to live the life that my mom had, you know. And I know that in watching my mom and going through what I did growing up, I did not want that. And then the second was that I know that that requires God, and that requires him to be able to trust him to take the next steps. And what does that mean? And what does this look like? So I was, that whole night, I was really, really scared, and I didn't know what it meant. And then I just got on my knees and I just prayed. And I remember saying, Lord, I know I don't know what to do. And I know that the next thing that I can do is just trust you and trust that you are going to be able to provide for me, because I can't go on without you. I physically cannot do it. So that was a huge redemption thing for me, and the huge another Lord telling me that I need to trust him and let's take this another step, which was, to me, was a huge step. But, yeah.
That's so cool. And let me tell you, the thing that is so awesome is how God has moved you from that place of fear to recognizing that He holds every day of your life in His hands.
Yeah.
And it's so cool to see how you've surrendered to Him and said, well, Lord, whatever day you give me, it's yours.
Yeah.
I'm going to use it for your glory. And so I'm so touched by that. And I know that so many people have been touched by the testimony of how you've surrendered your life to Him. I just want to ask you one other question. Mm-hmm. If there are people that are watching this that are struggling and going through a hard trial, whether it's a trial that they themselves are facing, or maybe it's something that they're facing because a friend or a family member is going through something difficult, how would you encourage them when it comes to trusting God and finding joy in the midst of that trial?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things for me is that when I got diagnosed and potentially got told what people will claim will be the worst news of my life, like the thing that will just should have knocked me down, right? And now looking back at that and what I thought I deserved, right? I thought I deserved that negative and that life, but God gave me that positive, but all the things that He brought to my life after that, right? And so now I can honestly say that, looking back in that moment when I was faced, when the doctor walked in the door and told me that was the best thing that He could have said, because it woke me up and it shook me into my core, and it made me realize that I need Christ, and He's the one that's only gonna be, you know, He's the only one that's able to save you through all the hard stuff, and that even if you're told whatever the case might be, like whatever it is that someone tells you and you think it's the worst thing ever, that honestly it could be the thing that changes your life and is the best thing ever. And I mean that, and people look at me like I'm crazy, but I get emotional when I think about it, because I think of God's love, and He's like, no, you deserve so much more than that. And I know that was hard and ugly, but you deserve this life and so much more. And I can't even comprehend God's love, but it is so great. And I think that there's power to that, in that sense of the fact that, that no matter what you're facing or what you're struggling with, that God has a purpose and a plan, and you're not alone, and you're loved more than you can even imagine, and that He wants so much more for you, and it's not to ruin you or to hurt you. And so I just remember that in those moments, that God has a plan for you and a purpose, and it might be hard, but He's the one that's guiding you, and He's the one that's going to hold you up when you feel like you just can't carry on. So I fully believe that God will be there for you through every step of the way, and that He will help you and guide you and protect you.
Such a powerful video. I think the thing that stuck out to me the most as I was watching that was when Allie was describing her reaction to the doctor's diagnosis. And she responded to it by saying, that was the best thing that the doctor could have said. Because after that night, she went back to her house and she was processing that. And what could have been the darkest moment of her entire life turned out to be a turning point in her walk with the Lord. Her crisis pushed her to make a decision to not battle through her disease on her own strength and in her own power, but instead to journey through it clinging to the Father. And as she made that decision, God's peace surrounded her, and His perfect peace that passes all understanding came in and filled her. Because she knew that she and God were going to get through it together. Today, you have that same opportunity to have that point in your moment in your life, just like Allie did, where you can say, you know what, God, I'm not going to go through these trials on my own anymore. I'm not going to try to face this in my own strength and in my own might. I'm going to do it with you. And that can be hard for a lot of us because we're stubborn and we're prideful and we want to try to figure it out on our own. But it's when we come down and we are broken that the Lord comes in and fills us with that peace and that comfort and the joy that we need to get through each day and to thrive in our life with Him, even amidst those dark times. Every day, Allie is faced with the truth that her healthy years are winding down. But when you talk to Allie, if you know her, you know what I'm talking about. You don't see a young woman who's worn down by the weight of this disease and what it means and the journey that she's been through and all the struggles in life. You don't see a young woman who's worn down by those things and oppressed by those things. What you see is a young woman with a bright smile, a fun personality, and an undeniable sense of joy that stems directly from her walk with the Lord. Isn't that cool? Brothers and sisters, we have so many reasons to experience joy in our lives, no matter what hardships we're facing. And the reason why has nothing to do with who we are. It has everything to do with who our God is. And the love that we experience, our relationship with God is so great that there's always a reason to smile, and there's always a reason to celebrate. And I mean, and I just wanted us to take a moment just to even think about, just beyond all the things we've talked about, all the reasons that we as believers in Jesus Christ have to find joy, even in the darkest times. I mean, we'll just walk through a few of them together. We get to have a relationship with the all-powerful God of the universe. Wow. And every day we get to experience his love for us. Every day he's our teammate and he always has our backs. He'll never leave us or forsake us, and we are never alone. Our relationship with him will last for eternity. That is so cool. God cares about each one of us specifically, and he has created a plan for each one of our lives. And this plan gives us purpose and a meaning and identity for our lives that we can experience. What about the fact that in heaven, we each get to experience heavenly bodies, and that we'll never get sick again, and we'll never